Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, it's me, Buzzkillers, your favorite professor, and we've got one of our favorite professors on the line on the internet in a minute. We're talking about programmed inequality, how Britain discarded women, technologists, and lost its edge in computing. Before the war, during the war, and after the war. Thank goodness we have the internet, and we're about to join Professor Hicks now. So here we are, Buzzkillers. Professor Hicks is on the line via the internet, and how are you, Professor? We're talking to you from Wisconsin. You're professor of history at the University of Wisconsin.
That's right. I'm doing well.
That's great. That's great. You've been on so many important media outlets recently, in the last few years, especially with your new book coming out, the BBC, NPR, public radio, other places. But of course, Professor Buzzkill is going to really kick your career into high gear because, after all, we're so much more famous and so much more powerful than those other media outlets.
That's what I'm counting on. Yeah,
it's great to have you. One of the things is. Our Buzzkillers out there, most of our Buzzkillers are American, but I was so impressed by this book that I thought they should hear this story and to talk about all these myths that need to be busted in this whole sort of atmosphere of discrimination against women in British computing. And presumably there's a similar thing going on with American computing. But I think most of our listeners, you know, they'll know about the Alan Turing story from the movies, and they'll know about now the Hidden Figures story. And I'm sort of interested to hear why, at least first, why you got interested in this specific period and this specific topic.
Sure. Well, you know, I kind of got interested in this specific period and looking at Great Britain because the U.S. history of technology is so overstudied. Everybody thinks that the U.S. was first, even when it wasn't. You know, the British had the first digital electronic computer. And I think that we actually do ourselves a disservice as Americans when we focus only on our own history, because there's a lot to be said about making implicit comparisons or making comparisons with other national contexts so that we can actually better understand what's happening in our own national context. And that's why I think the UK story is so important for us today, because the UK was a fading empire in the 20th mm-hmm. century, trying to use technology to save itself. And honestly, that's very similar to what the US is going through in the 21st century. So in this case, as in many others, British history is something we can really learn from.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Well, how did Britain sort of start off with the lead in computing? Of course, there was the invention of the first sort of what we would call a computer. But then how it really took a lead early on. Was it all Alan Turing and his ilk, or was something more going on?
There was a lot more going on. And the thing is, Turing was very important. He was very smart. He did some very interesting things. But one of the reasons that he is just kind of expanded to fill our view in the history of computing is because he was treated so, so terribly by the government after the war. And he ended up committing suicide. And also because, you know, he was gay at a point in time when obviously that was very dangerous, and he was unapologetic about it. So he's become kind of a queer icon, and that's terrific. But it also means that other people who were just as important technologically kind of faded in the background, like Tommy Flowers, who actually designed and built the first electronic computer. And the reason that these great advancements were made during World War II in Great Britain is because they were just having the daylights bombed out of them during the war. At a certain point during the Blitz, this is, you know, when German bombers are really trying to bomb the country into submission, there were actually more people dying on the quote-unquote home front than there were men fighting at the actual front. And so every last bit of information that they could wring out of, you know, the German messages that they were intercepting that they could decode quickly enough to act on militarily was so, so important. And that's where you get the need for electronic computing. And that's why during World War II, the British actually had not one, but by the end of the war, 10 electronic computers in action, breaking codes in a way that changed the course of the war. The Allies knew where to land, where and when to land on D-Day because of the information unlocked by these British computers. And as you know, D-Day was what changed, essentially turned the tide of World War II in the Allies' favor.
Absolutely, in the European theater. One of the things I found so fascinating was that your book dispels the myth that Bletchley Park, for instance, was, you know, more or less just a handful of mathematical geniuses trying to crack Enigma. I sort of got a sort of Scooby-Doo sense of it. You know, there was this group of five or six or seven, you know, super people running around doing all this stuff. But there were a lot more women involved at kind of all levels. Can you explain more to the Buzzkillers about that?
Yeah, it's funny, right, how Bletchley Park starts to look when we see it in popular culture. The film that just came out, you know, recently about Turing, it doesn't even have in the story these enormously important computers. It only has the older, slower electromechanical computer, the bomb, that Turing was involved with. It doesn't even talk about the Colossus computers. And so it gives this totally, you know, false account of what happened. And likewise, it wasn't a handful of, like, you know, really smart people breaking codes. There were some very smart people who were breaking codes in these sort of like manual, very mathematically based ways. But there were thousands of people working at Bletchley Park, and
thousands?
They were over thousands throughout the war. Thousands of people milled in and out working at the park, and they were not just majority, but almost entirely women, because most of the men were, you know, were at the front.
Oh, well, see, that's so fascinating, because in the Enigma movies we've seen, or general popular presentation, we only hear about Joan Scott, but then we also hear about the Wrens, who are intercepting, you know, the coded messages, but all they're doing is taking them down.
Right.
But you're arguing, and you argue convincingly in the book, that they're involved in all sorts of things at Bletchley.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that we didn't know this until pretty recently is because all of these people who worked at Bletchley Park were threatened with death if they ever talked about what they did during the war. You know, they had to sign, going into and going out of Bletchley, they had to sign loyalty oaths that said, you will not talk to anybody about what you have done here. And in the 1970s, when some of this information started to leak out, and people started to realize, okay, we can at least talk about this a little bit. You know, some of the women who had worked there said things like, it's really a shame, like, you know, my husband died before I was ever able to tell him what I'd done during the war. And to this day, there are women who are coming forward in their 90s saying, oh, okay, I can talk about this now. You know, I'm going to go interview some of the women who operated the Colossus computers actually later this year. And they're all, you know, they're all in their 90s.
Well, that's so amazing, because you would think that what happened from 45 to 49 anyway, or maybe 45 to 55, was that the new computers and the new computing would have so outstripped the World War II technology and World War II design of computers that what happened at Bletchley would be almost like, you know, archaeology. It didn't matter that if the secrets were out.
You would think, right? But the thing was that the war for the British was so incredibly traumatic. And then after the war, they find themselves in this very frightening position where they're losing their power as an empire. They're sliding into second-rate world power status. They're locked sort of in the middle of this Cold War confrontation between the two superpowers of the USSR and the US. And they're terrified that basically they're going to get bombed off the map again, only now it's going to be nuclear weapons.
Oh, so there is a sort of wartime mentality that continues for the decade after the war.
Very much so. And I mean, even in very material ways, the British still had rationing through the 1950s. Like, they had food rationed.
Yeah. That's always a fascinating story. Maybe we should do a whole separate show on that. But what interested me so much was that not only were the great numbers of women recruited during the war for computer work, but the work that they did seemed to be so fascinating and so direct, not only to the war effort, but direct to the development of computing and programming.
Yeah, yeah. So women were doing everything from putting together these machines, putting together the hardware, troubleshooting and testing the hardware to make sure it worked, then programming and operating the computers. And just to give a taste of the fact that, you know, this was important work, even if it wasn't necessarily seen so at the time, or even in retrospect, we don't maybe see it as that important. Mm-hmm. In the report on machine code breaking at Bletchley Park, it's called the Tunney Report, they actually write about how even though all the machine work was essentially being done by women, the higher ups say, you know, we find that when we actually make men cryptographers do machine work in addition to just doing the non-machine code breaking that they're doing, they come up with better insights and they do their work better and more quickly. So they actually arrive at the breaks that they're trying to make more quickly because the machine work was actually really complex and taught people things about how to be better code breakers.
So there's no way, in no sense, in which this the work that women computer operators were doing was secretarial or was just data entry. This was real programming at the sort of, you know, cliff face, right at the cutting edge.
Exactly. It was cutting edge, and the women who were doing it, they were part of all of the training in the park, in Bletchley Park, that was also given to men recruits, you know, to the people mm-hmm. who were working alongside Alan Turing. They were taking that same training, going to those same lectures in order to be able to break codes and do their jobs effectively.
Okay, so then what happens after the war? I mean, it's not a comfortable situation. The country's still recovering. Again, as you say, there was rationing until the early 50s. As far as computing and programming as a field of women's work or women work for women, what happens in the 50s? Was it because did the Bletchley experience help any of that? Did the government say, well, look, we have all these experts here. Let's change the way things work in terms of programming and computing in general?
It's interesting because things were kept so secret after the war in terms of what had gone on at Bletchley with computing. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of a disjuncture in terms of the hardware, but not in terms of the skills, right? Because you can break down machines as the Wrens were made to break down their machines at the end of the war, and you can kind of destroy that part, but you can't mm-hmm. destroy what's inside people's heads. And that's actually, you know, that's what cost Turing his life in the end, the fact that sure. the government can't destroy what's in his head, and they're afraid that those secrets are going to come out. And so there is this carryover of skills into the post-war period, both with the women who are working on computers and with the mostly men who are designing computers. And the thing that I think is really interesting, a myth that I would like to bust, if you will, is this idea that that the end of the war chased women out of the field of computing. It didn't, because at this point in time, the field is still seen as so kind of de-skilled and unimportant that no men want to do this kind of work. It's not a career, you know, it's not a job that's seen as appropriate for young men who will be essentially white-collar professionals, and nor do they want, you know, to just have working-class men in it. So what that means is it falls to women who are sort of an in-between. They're a pink-collar labor force. And so after the war, as computers do go from being electromechanical to becoming fully electronic, that just means that the women who are operating and programming them, they carry right over. And you see women again and again in computing ads of this period. But the funny thing is, it's not just in ads. They're not just there to kind of put a pretty face next to the machine. In real life, major British computing companies had these training teams that would go out and train people how to program and how to use their new computers they had just bought. And these training teams were all women.
Oh, wow. So they're leading, in a way, the post-war transformation to a computing society.
Exactly. They're these technological emissaries. They're actually the programmers, not just programmers, but people who are training other people how to program.
Okay, well, let's take a break quickly for a sponsorship, and we'll come back and we'll talk about more about what happened after the war. And, of course, what I was fascinated by, the getting married problem and the having children problem. Okay, we're back with Professor Hicks from the University of Wisconsin. Professor, could you explain what I talked about just before the break was called the getting married problem?
So one of the things that happens is that when these jobs are essentially just seen as jobs, they don't have a career ladder, women are terrific candidates for them in the eyes of the people who are doing the hiring. Management wants women in these jobs because they don't expect that women will need or want careers. So women will just program and operate computers for, you know, maybe they'll have a 5-year stint doing this, and then they'll get married and they'll go off into the sunset is the idea. And they won't be, you know, they won't be doing these jobs anymore, and they won't need jobs anymore. But what actually starts to happen that works against these, well, these women who are technical experts as the field professionalizes, is management starts to say, oh, hang on, you know, we're starting to understand that these jobs are actually more important than we thought. We really need to make these into career-long positions. And once you have them being career-long positions, you can start to imagine what happens. No longer are women the go-to labor force, because the idea is that, well, women can't have careers because they're just going to drop out of the labor force to go get married anyway.
And this is a cultural assumption that works in probably most big employment categories in the UK at the time, getting married problem and then the having children problem.
Exactly. And the really sad thing about this, aside from, you know, just being discriminatory, is that even though women would leave the workforce to get married and go have children, that never meant that they left the workforce for good. In very few cases did women, like, just leave the workforce forever. What would happen is they'd leave for a few years, they'd get married, have children, and then once their children were kind of old enough for school, they would go back to part-time work, or they would go back to full-time work. And so they very easily could have been retained and kind of gone on in technical work and been very useful. But because those now high status jobs didn't really want to accommodate, like, people who had to have breaks in their careers, the women who went back to work, even if they had all of these technical skills, they would just go back to work as a secretary, or they go back to work in factory work, or they go back and do something that didn't take advantage of the potential that they had.
Oh, so at a low, if you will, a lower level job than what they'd had before they went to get married or have children.
Exactly.
Lower level position.
Exactly. A job that basically would allow more flexibility because it was a job that wasn't as professionalized.
What things that really grabs me about this is so many people seem to think, you know, the war changed all that. You had Rosie River in the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that, you know, gender norms before the war were broken down. Pre-war gender norms were broken down by the war, and the need for war work, especially in Britain, where it was, you know, absolutely emergency work. And then after that, the war attitude continued, but it doesn't.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about the post-war period, and it happens in the U.S. as well as the U.K. After the war, there is a huge cultural backlash. There's this famous writer who wrote a book called The Naked Civil Servant. His name's Quentin Crisp, and he was very flamboyant. He was queer, and he has this great line. He says, you know, during the war, London in the blackout was like a giant paved double bed. And he was going around and, you know, having a great time and having sex with all these GIs, because during the war, basically, anything went. And yeah. women in particular kind of got out from under the thumb of like their fathers or their husbands or their families in this period. They actually had a lot more freedom during the war because they had to go and, you know, work for the good of the country. And so a lot of women remember the war as like this very exciting time where they had a lot more opportunity than later on, because what happens later on in the 50s, and this is, again, like to just connect it back to something we mentioned before, this is part of the reason Alan Turing gets ensnared in being accused and brought up on charges of, you know, indecent acts. It was because of this moral backlash after the war, which was trying to kind of put things back in place, put things back to supposedly, ideally, how they were supposed to be after mm-hmm. the great, you know, turmoil of the war.
Yeah, but you would think that especially for Britain, where the war is still the war and still talked about such a big consciousness changing thing, even now, that would have included these different gender roles or a breakdown in pre-war conceptions, and it just doesn't. It's amazing how completely it all snaps back.
Yeah, I agree. You know, you would think there would be a bit more of an understanding, seeing all of the important work that women did during the war and how that helped save the country. You would think there'd be an understanding of, well, if we mobilize women's labor as effectively in peacetime, just imagine how much better our economy will be. So it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, but yet this sort of thing happens in a lot of different contexts.
Yeah, and as you say, in the U.S. as well. It makes me wonder whether the war, you know, subconsciously in the culture is seen as an aberration. And we, even though it had to change these work roles for all sorts of reasons, we definitely don't want to continue that. We want to go back.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right.
Could we talk a little bit more about how specifically the field of programming and programming as an occupation in Britain becomes almost completely cut off from them? Because in one way, you might think that, well, computers and computing is so new that gender roles wouldn't, apply. But why did that sort of specific thing happen the way it did?
Yeah, you would think so. And early on, you'd be right that the field is kind of so new and unknown that these barriers to women doing it haven't been erected yet. And in the early days of computer programming, you know, this is sort of before we even have the category of programmer, right? Before programmer is even something that's a job. And so women are programming, but they're also doing what we would now call systems analysis. They're often operating the computers as well. And it's this sort of like catch-all role for computer workers at this point in time. And as the perception of computers as really powerful, useful tools starts to permeate into the upper echelons of management. In other words, managers start to realize how important these computers are, and not just that they're kind of tools that can help them get work done faster, but they're actually changing possibilities, changing the landscape of what like industry and government can do. There starts to be this push to get young men into computer jobs because they say, hey, you know, these jobs are too important to be left to women. And this leads to this kind of bifurcation of the jobs into people who will just do sort of the better parts of the jobs, like programming and systems yeah. analysis, and then other people who will be sort of shoved into doing things like data entry or operating the computers or things that they think that young men who are white collar won't want to do as part of their career progression. There's this really telling quote that I think I use in the book that's in one of the documents I found in the British National Archives, where a bunch of managers in government are trying to figure out how to get more young men to be interested in computing. And one of them says, well, look, in order to be a trained computer programmer, one of the things that you have to do is you have to do punching, basically data entry. You have to punch cards. And they say, you know, well, look, young men aren't going to want to do that. And that's like basically the first, that's the entry level step in this job category. And so the other manager just says, oh, okay, well, that's no problem. We'll just have the women do that, you know, so that will be part of the job trajectory for women, but it won't be the part of the job trajectory if we hire young men. And we'll just make it clear to the young men, they don't have to do that low level work.
So as computers are eventually seen as powerful and more powerful tools, then they kind of have to be programmed by men, because that's where all the power in theory comes from, and the women computer operators have to be sort of downgraded, right? Because you can't leave – the idea is you can't leave powerful things to women who might leave or who might not have this sort of intellectual background for it. So the thinking went.
Right. And not only not have intellectual background for it, interestingly, that was an assumption I went into with the archives, that they would think women weren't smart enough for the jobs.
Yeah.
But that wasn't actually what they were saying. They were afraid women were just, they were smart enough to do them. But the thing is, they were unreliable because they, like you said, they might just leave the jobs, but also they weren't management. And they never would be. And so they were very dangerous. They wanted to get these jobs into the hands of people who were not just men, but who were aligned with the interests of management. You know, so they didn't want working class men doing them either.
Yeah, this is fascinating, because one of the things that's so clear in the book is there's a lot of discussion about this, these issues among the sort of management class, if you will. And they're not afraid, or they're not careful. In the 50s and 60s, as we might be now, people might be now, to sort of, you know, be more careful about how they couch the language, that what they're really trying to get across. They're very open about wanting to have a gender division.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they take it for granted that men and women do different jobs, that it's not appropriate, it's not seen as appropriate by men for women to be in positions of power. So women can't be managers unless they're managing just women, which means they can't really be managers. You know, they can only be very low-level managers of staff. But even so, I had to do a lot of digging in the archives to find some of the things that I really wanted to find and understand, like how certain things worked on a very basic level. And one of the things I wanted to really understand was, did these jobs flip in gender just because women kind of left and, you know, they weren't replaced by other women? Or did women actually get actively pushed out? And I did find instances where women were actively pushed out of their jobs. They trained their replacements, essentially, and then they were demoted into assistantships below their new male replacements, whom they had just trained. And they did hide those stories in the archives. They tried not to make those stories that easy to find, because it was, even at that time, you know, it was clear that was embarrassing and not something that should be made obvious. So, for instance, that story that I actually start my book out with, I only found it because I was struggling to read through this kind of pile of handwritten memos that was stuffed in the back of a file of typewritten memoranda.
Oh, right. The joys of archival work. Well, let's take a break for station identification for Buzzkill Nation. When we get back, I'd like to talk more about, you know, what happens in the 60s and the 70s, especially during what was known as its Britain's white heat new economy. So back in a minute.
Hello, this is Lady Buzzkill. If you simply must follow my husband's deluded podcast hobby, you can also find him on Facebook, Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and Instagram at Professor Buzzkill. You might go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com if you're so inclined, and support him on Patreon. Subscribe to his email list, if you must, and shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. The only thing that seems to keep him from making more noise and frightening the horses is that the Professor Buzzkill Show is part of Entertainment One's podcast network. And of course, it's available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Finally, I suppose I should thank you for listening. So, thank you for listening.
Okay, we're back with Professor Hicks from the University of Wisconsin talking about her wonderful book and new research on programmed inequality, how Britain discarded women technologists and lost its edge in computing. Professor, one of the things that's so fascinating about what you've done and what we've talked about now is how, you know, these gender preconceptions from before the war, after the war, don't change, but then they start to change in the 60s and 70s. How does that kind of happen? I should mention, by the way, to the buzzkillers, the civil service as a career path is much more important in Britain and was much more important in Britain than it is in the United States. So that's a very big deal. And when you talk a lot about how computing sort of leaks its way into the civil service, that means a lot to a lot of people, much more than it would in the United States post office, for instance, I think. But how did the gender preconceptions start to change?
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you brought that up about the importance of working for the government, because in the post-war, the decades after World War II, not only is the civil service huge and not only is like working for the government huge, but the UK has actually nationalized a lot of industries.
Right.
They have essentially taken over, you know, like they've taken over transport and energy producing industries. So a lot of people, a lot more people are being affected by what the government is doing regarding computing than might be evident at first glance. The government is by far the largest computer user in this period. Mm-hmm. And so your question about, like, so how does it change? Like, how does this gender flip start to happen? It changes very suddenly. It's not evolutionary. It's basically managers start getting together. They start talking to each other, both within government and industry, and they start talking to each other through, like, the pages of management magazines and advice on, like, who to hire for certain jobs. And they just say, we need to get young men who have potential to be managers and who have like long-term career aspirations. We need to get them into computing jobs. Otherwise, we're risking getting into a situation where nobody in management understands how these machines work.
Right. And is there any, by the way, is there any sort of cross-cultural attention being paid? You know, do they pay attention to what's going on in the United States? Do they say, well, look, this is happening in the United States, therefore we need to be careful about how we continue with this old notion about gender roles and employment? Or is the same thing happening here?
Yeah, very, very much so. The UK is looking across the Atlantic to kind of help them decide what to do technologically. Mm-hmm. And during this period in the US and also in the UK, there's sort of this idea of the technocrat is gaining steam.
Right.
The person who is essentially going to be a technical expert who, by virtue of that, is a better manager. And so they look across the Atlantic and they think, in the U.S., one of the things that we see is that it's okay for, you know, white men at the apex of power to be technical. And we need to encourage more of that in the UK, because the UK class system for a long time made it so that, you know, people who were professional and white collar, they didn't even want to touch a machine. They didn't want to touch
right.
an office computer because it meant lowering their status, essentially.
Sure. They would be essentially clerks. Yeah.
Yeah, and even more so, they would almost be seen as akin to like light industrial workers. There was this term, the industrialization of the office that was used a lot during this period, and it made it clear that, you know, even working with a computer and doing very intellectual work with a computer was just automatically seen as somewhat de-skilled and downgraded and unintellectual because a machine was involved.
Wow. Then, of course, in the 60s, in the 70s, there's this idea that Britain should punch above its weight, should create this new white heat economy. And that fails sort of famously and spectacularly. But how devastating was, you know, British employment practice and gender job assignment for the failure of that white heat economy?
Yeah, this is the part to me where it gets really interesting, because this is the part that I had no idea about. You know, I went into the archive sort of knowing there had been a gendered labor change, and I wanted to understand more about why that happened. But then once I got into the archives and, you know, you start pulling threads and going further and further, what I essentially realized was right at the part right at the point in time when the UK is trying to, like you said, punch above its weight globally, they're trying to use technology to like regain their imperial power, essentially. That's the point of time when they are being racked with programmer labor shortages that is making them unable to actually like leverage computing in the way that they want to for, you know, for this new revolution, this technological revolution, which Harold Wilson calls the era of white heat. He thinks it's going to, you know, it's going to save the country from sliding into oblivion and just losing all of its world power. And so they're being hurt by the fact that they don't have enough people to do these jobs. And at the exact same time, they are discarding all of the people who can do these jobs, who have the skills to do these jobs, just because they're women. And so it's like this, it's this crazy, crazy situation. And they didn't see at the time what they were doing. But looking back in retrospect, you know, we look at it and we're like, how could they not have seen it? But gender roles are, you know, even today, they're very taken for granted. And and a lot of times people just assume, well, it's got to be this way.
Because, I thought about it like this. The white heat economy idea, the white heat economy plan, if you will, the new economy plan, is a pretty good idea in theory, right? Especially for a country that's in the position that Britain's in after the war. But then they can't seem to get away from being hamstrung by these now, by the time they're thinking about this, 40 and 50-year-old conceptions.
Yeah. I want to complicate that just a little bit, because I see what you're saying. Like, I think definitely trying to use technology to improve things for a nation is a good idea. But so much of white heat was about trying to enhance Britain's position at the expense of other nations. You know, Britain had essentially now lost all its colonies. It had lost its undue influence over and power over many other nations that had gained independence, you know, had finally gotten free of essentially British control and British oppression. And so white heat is essentially about trying to reinstantiate that kind of domination and implicitly that kind of oppression, but just using new and different types of technologies, not using guns, but using computers.
Oh, I see. Using computing technology to replace shipping and warmongering and things like that.
Yeah. That, you know, hey, if we can't control a nation's economy using, you know, railroads and, like you said, shipping and guns, maybe we can control a nation's economy because we're the only ones who can supply them the computers they need now. And we're the technical experts who will come in and tell them how they have to do things. You know, maybe we'll get to control some of like the highest levels of their industry and government because they'll need to rely on us for those technologies.
Right. And there's still the sort of Commonwealth friendship and Commonwealth economic agreements, right, that don't exactly operate like a European Union, but, you know, Canada and Australia and New Zealand and places like that look first to Britain rather than to the open international market for new technology and things like that. And that may have held them back as well.
Well, right. Yeah, this was very much something that was helping the UK because, like you said, Canada, even India, they were more likely to buy a British computer than an American computer early on. You know, they had dealt with the British. They had some sort of, if not affinity, at least familiarity with the British that that really helped the UK. And the UK was kind of poised to be a really strong competitor in computing and, you know, like against IBM globally for this reason. And then, you know, they really, for reasons I'm sure we'll get into later, the UK really messes that up.
Well, let's get into it now. How do they mess it up? I mean, they mess it up partly because they're cutting their own throat with this workforce and computing leadership problem. But are there other ways in which this becomes a serious economic problem? Because they lose out in a lot of industries, and I'm wondering whether this is an economy-wide problem or if it's specifically bad in computing.
It's specifically bad in computing. They have this very precipitous decline in computing. Mm-hmm. And this is where it goes back to like pulling that thread through the archives. Because they don't have enough people to run and program these computers, the government in particular starts saying, oh no, we're getting into a position where basically the state, the nation, will not be able to function because everything is now computerized. You know, mm-hmm. public utilities are computerized. The welfare state, which takes in taxes and pays out benefits, that's run by massive, massive computer installations. And so if we don't have enough people to experts to run these computers, we're going to be in a really bad state. And so the government has a very sort of strong role in what the computer industry produces as a result of being such a huge customer and funding computing. And they say, in order to function with this now smaller labor force that we have, because we've discarded, all of the women who were doing it, and right. the men who are coming into the field, a lot of young men come into the field and they train, and then they leave the field pretty quickly. They don't actually want to do the work because this is still not seen as really like high status work, you know? So it's a struggle to retain the sorts of workers that they want to retain, these sort of higher status management workers. And so given this, the government says to the computer industry, look, we want you to merge down into a single company. The last remaining sort of viable computer companies are supposed to merge into a bigger company that can provide massive mainframe solutions, which can be run from very centralized locations by fewer numbers of computer people. And they say to the newly merged company, ICL, International Computers Limited, you have to make these for us. The nation's prosperity and future depends on it, essentially. And ICL does. And the problem is that even though the big 2900 series mainframe that they come up with and they provide that fits the parameters the government's setting out, is even though this is a very technologically advanced system, they've yeah. been made to provide the mother of all mainframes during a period when the mainframe is on the way out.
Oh,
and people,
I see.
Yeah, and industry is turning to smaller, more flexible systems and more decentralized systems. And by the time ICL gives the government this this mainframe series, even the government doesn't want what it asked for anymore. And essentially the British computing industry, which is now just this one company largely, it just kind of crumbles as a result. So it's not as though IBM came in and, beat the British computing industry. They just kind of came in and, cleaned up the mess after the British had shot themselves in the foot. And this uh-huh. is why the British computing industry goes from actually very globally competitive to not globally competitive at all in a very short frame of time. It's not because people in India or people in Canada are saying, oh, IBM is so much better. It's because the British are taking themselves out of the game with these decisions they're making about technological design based on their labor shortages.
Well, what years are we talking about? Is this the early 80s now, or is this start to happen in the 70s still?
This is in the late 60s into the early 70s. The merger happens in 1968, and then by 1974, ICL is essentially dead in the water.
So does the British computing industry recover? Is it, you know, new? What happens in the 80s and 90s, if you don't mind me taking you out of your, technically out of your time period?
It does, in a sense, because there's kind of this paradigm shift, you know, and new companies and new people come in to solve problems of now microcomputing and personal computing, essentially. So in the 80s, there's the BBC Micro, and there are even, you know, today there's, I think they call it the Silicon Fen, the Cambridgeshire area, which has a lot of high tech stuff going on. So it's not like it's not a permanent thing, but it does, you know, it seriously takes them out of the game for at least a decade.
Wow. So most of the 70s then and some of the 80s is just lays fallow.
Pretty much. And the ways in which they might have been able to capitalize and build upon what had been, you know, a good lead in this industry, that goes out the window.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing. Well, so one of the things we like to do when we interview historians is to ask them, what are you working on now? And how does what you've published with Programmed Inequality, how does that lead into what you're going to produce soon?
Well, what I'm working on now, and it's still in the early stages, is sort of a deep prehistory of algorithmic bias. So in other words, I want to look at the ways that computing systems, and we're all familiar with this now, how computing systems often are set up in ways that kind of assume certain identities or privilege certain identities over others. For instance, if you go to a drop-down box and you have to select your gender, a lot of the time there's only two options, right? Or if you are married to somebody of the same gender, a lot of times a computer system won't take that into account. And there's all sorts of different ways that we see bias in computer systems today according to categories of race or gender or sexuality, all of these various things. And there's a lot of great work being done on that today in like sociology and media studies. But what I really want to do is look at the very early prehistory of how this starts to happen, even back in the mainframe era. And the way this is related to programmed inequality is because when I was doing the research for that book, I started finding in the records of what was the largest computer center in Britain at the time. This was the government computer center that was running millions of accounts for the welfare state and collecting taxes. I found some indication that there were transgender people who were writing to the government in order to try to get their pensions paid out to them correctly. And I started using the British version of the Freedom of Information Act to get more and more of those files opened. But I had to wait several years. Like, it was a very slow process. And what I found when those files were actually finally opened was that there were hundreds of trans people writing to the government, asking them to correct the gender on their pension cards. And the government was programming this massive computing system specifically not to see trans people. In other words, they were accommodating some of these requests in a manual fashion, but they were simultaneously changing the programming of the computer to see each and every one of those trans people's cases as an exception code and as an actually to return an error.
Oh, right. So, and given that there are that many people asking, presumably there have been a lot of people who didn't bother to ask because they were afraid what the answer might be. This is not a fringe population. This is a lot of people.
Right. And imagine what a difference it would have made to allowing these folks to get their benefits more easily if instead of being programmed out of the system. They had actually been programmed into it and been accommodated by it.
Sure. Of course, now that I think about it, I don't know that I see anything but male and female. Granted, I'm not looking for a wider selection, but in American computing or American, you know, when I deal with the government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it seems to be still the same way.
It still is in a lot of cases. I mean, there are some places that have gone to offering options like, you know, non-binary and genderqueer. But most drop-down boxes you encounter where you have to state, you know, what your gender is, you don't have more than two choices.
They don't even have other, you know, which is a little bit insulting category, but it would at least be different.
Yeah. And another interesting thing that I know from other people's work who work on this issue in the contemporary period is that even when you see a drop-down box that has, say, like a genderqueer and a non-binary option, sometimes what's going on in the coding behind the scenes when you select those options is that it basically doesn't even take it into account. You just get kind of put into a non-marked pile. So even though it looks like it's doing something to accommodate you, it isn't really.
It's just keeping you quiet by offering what you think might be a choice.
Right. Or in the worst cases, sometimes it just codes you as female, I heard.
Oh, right. Well, we look forward to seeing that in its published form when it comes out. So thanks again, Professor. It's been great having you on, Professor Buzzkill. And we hope that Buzzkillers will go to the Buzzkill bookshelf and pick up a copy of Programmed Inequality from MIT Press.
And one thing I just wanted to let you know, which I'm pretty excited about, is that Programmed Inequality will be coming out in paperback soon.
Wow. And for an academic book to come out in paperback so quickly shows that it's getting very good reception across the wide readerships out there. So there you have it, Buzzkillers, and we'll talk to you next week.